Welcome back. Let's continue our question and answer and interview seminar. What does my personal vehicle log look like? There are four parts to the personal vehicle log: the date, the description why you used your personal vehicle, the beginning odometer, and the ending odometer. Probably the most controversial portion is the description, or what you used your personal vehicle for. I'll give you some examples. Picking up parts, went to accountant's office. Pick up truck supplies, went to move equipment, went to bank. Picked up equipment, drop truck for service, pick up truck from service, and miscellaneous errands for the truck. It's important to remember the Income Tax Act is very clear. Going to and from work is not tax deductible. You must remember that your head office is your personal home. Therefore, anything that you put into your personal vehicle log cannot say things like went to work or came back from work. Use the proper description. Can the corporation also write off the business use of home expense? Yes, but be careful. Being unreasonable or greedy may imply personal income. Canada has no capital gains on personal dwelling. Too much home write-offs may disqualify personal dwelling status. It's not an exact science. For your information, home mortgage interest is not deductible. Only gas, electric, heating, maintenance, repair, insurance, taxes, phone, internet. I have a story about an auditor whose husband had a side business. I think he was buying cars and renting them out. He went out and he bought himself a computer. And the wife, I don't think, appreciated him buying the computer. And so there was a little bit of a conflict there. When the husband told the wife that the reason why he bought the computer was so that he could write it off as an expense, she said that you have to divide what your personal use of that computer is versus the business use. He promptly shrugged his shoulders and says, "I'm going to find another accountant." Personal use of home computer can be portioned off personal versus business use. It's a very fine line we're walking. There is still a square footage calculation method. For example, a 2,000 square foot house and a 200 square foot office has 10% of all of the expenses written off. Should the corporation build a shop on my personal land? I'm going to say no. What you want to do is build equity outside your corporation, not inside. If your company owns the building and you want to depreciate it as an expense, that means that when you sell your home and a building, the corporation must pay capital gains on the appreciation. As I stated before, Canada has no capital gains on personal dwellings, but it does have capital gains on business assets. It's more important to retain the capital gains exemption than to have the business expense. It's best to rent or lease the building to your corporation. However, there may be a possible personal tax implication to this as well. It's not an exact science. Sometimes if the rent lease is low enough, it doesn't flag income status. You have to fix it based on commercial retail rent in your jurisdiction. What about quarterly tax installments? Can you stop paying them? The answer to this is yes, but usually you still pay interest until the end of the year. On income you haven't or may not even make. CRA will stop asking you for installments when they see you are no longer self-employed. However, it may take as long as 2 years. You may not have to deal with tax installments in the future, but you will have to deal with your T4 source deductions. GST. What happens to existing and future GST returns? Your accountant usually cancels your existing personal GST number after the sale of your truck into your corporation. In this way, you can make sure everything is claimed. A new GST number will be assigned to the corporation. Our firm completes GST returns monthly rather than quarterly. However, if you are not punctual in your paperwork submission, it's probably best to complete it quarterly. Canada Revenue Agency holds all returns if there is anything outstanding. If you're consistently 3 to 5 weeks late, mathematically, you may never get a GST return. They would hold it indefinitely. They still owe it to you, but they won't release it until there's no outstanding paperwork. Employer-employee agreement. What can all be included? Lots of things. First, the employer-employee agreement should be clear with definitions and the relationship. Corporate purchases should be accepted with use of personal payment devices, such as debit and credit card. The agreement should be very clear on the salary, the terms of payment, such as when, allowable partial payments, terms of breach, the per diem rate, say linked to the Treasury Board or National Joint Council, should have maybe an option for a simplified system or a detailed system, domestic establishment reduction for those who run day cabs, private non-commercial accommodation allowance, which deals with showers and amenities, personal vehicle log rate, linked again to the Treasury Board of Canada or National Joint Council websites, available for multiple vehicles, quads, miscellaneous vehicles, etc. It should also include the business use of personal or real property, parking and plugging, parking, storing and heating, corporate equipment detailed, office space with the square footage, benefits such as dental and medical plan, and all of the conditions of employment, such as cell phone, head office landline usage, steel-toed shoes, safety equipment, etc. There are a lot of things that can be included. If you have any more questions, ask your accountant. Life insurance. Can it be deductible? Yes, but you need a shareholder buyout agreement. If there are two shareholders and one dies, the shares must be paid out to the estate. This would place the corporation insolvent. Assets would have to be sold. Directors must consider the possibility of this risk and can direct the corporation to purchase insurance on the shareholders. This means the corporation owns the life insurance policy on the shareholders. If someone dies, the proceeds can be paid out to the estate through a capital dividend account, which is tax-free, the same as personal. However, it must be set up right initially through your accountant and insurance provider. If you don't have an agreement and the premiums are expensed through the corporation, the proceeds are taxable. Period. We'll now talk with an insurance salesman. His name is Tim. So let's get down to business. Okay, national averages say $50,000 to $55,000 a year is taxable income for an average truck driver. Unless, of course, they use the per diem system, which is $25,000 to $30,000 on line 150 of their T1. If I get sick or injured, what happens? I have truck payments, mortgage payments, living expenses. What do you think my options are?
Well, there's basically two different options. The first one is income replacement insurance, and the second one would be saving for such an inopportune event to happen.
Income replacement. What different options are there in there?
Well, with an income replacement insurance, it's an insurance that can be purchased. The first option would be disability insurance, and the second one would be workers' compensation, which is a provincially regulated insurance done through the government.
As a lease owner-operator, either the trucking company or the individual operator purchases their workman's compensation. So everybody is covered or should be covered under workman's compensation if you're a lease owner-operator.
Correct.
Let's first talk about workers' compensation and find out what they all cover, and then we'll look at other options.
Workers' compensation is a program arranged by the government where the employers and employees are paid in to the plan, and what happens is it covers 90% of a person's take-home pay. So it's not necessarily their taxable income that is covered, it's their take-home pay. And what they have is they have a formula that basically measures what that would be, and they get it pretty accurate.
Workers' compensation is a provincially managed government program, correct?
That's correct, yes. And most of them are quite similar from one province to the next. It's quite similar across Canada. It does cover work-related health issues that prevent someone from working. And they are both a work-related accident and also a work-related illness. However, typically the illness is very hard to prove and actually be work-related, so it most often is relegated to work-related accident.
So if you're sick of your dispatcher, that doesn't go fall under work-related.
Well, not quite.
Let's say, for instance, now workman's compensation determines a particular remuneration, whether I'm ill or whether I broke my leg or whatever it is. They've calculated what that is. Is it a taxable income or is it not a taxable income?
It's not a taxable income. Disability insurance, for the most part, is not considered taxable income. It's based on take-home pay. They have a formula for that that they use.
When we're dealing with workman's compensation, an individual's taxable income on line 150 of their T1 drops from $55,000 to $25,000 to $30,000, not including the per diem. We're talking a dramatic drop in living expense reimbursement, I guess you would call it, or what do you call it?
Yeah, that would be an insurance payment that they would be getting. And yeah, it's quite unfortunate because the truckers that use the per diem system have a tremendous tax advantage there. But what ends up happening when they sign up with the workers' compensation is the coverage that they receive ends up getting dropped down by around half. So what ends up happening is the income that they've really been used to living with doesn't cover their mortgage payments and their living expenses the way it would have.
So let's say we do break our leg and we have workers' compensation. Do we have a choice whether we claim workers' compensation or can we get something other than workers' compensation if it's going to be cut in half?
Yeah.
Your money, not your leg.
So in addition to workers' compensation, a person can get individual or group disability insurance policies, which also cover them in the event of disability that prevents somebody from working. And advantage of some of these things are, number one, they don't necessarily have to be work-related. People who become disabled, it's most often not work-related. It's very often a person is out snowmobiling, breaks a leg or slipped on ice while at home, breaks a hip or something like that, and they're off work for a considerable time, and it's not work-related.
How does private or personal disability insurance relate to workman's compensation? Is it an either or? What's the relationship there?
Well, workers' compensation is so common. When somebody does set up their own individual disability insurance policy, what they typically do is they piggyback on each other. And in the event that somebody gets disabled, then one or the other will pay. And
not both?
Not both. That would be nice. But the only thing is that would give incentive for somebody to become disabled.
Oh.
So, no, they don't pay both.
What should I be looking for in personal disability insurance to supplement the real losses that's occurring?
Well, see, what happens is, like I said before, most of the workers' compensation coverage is based on work-related accidents, whereas most claims that occur end up happening at home. The other issue that occurs is that workers' compensation accidents are typically not very long in duration. If somebody gets injured at work, they might be off for a month or two and then they're back to work, even if they break their leg. However, most claims that come in that are longer in duration are related to illness, and workers' compensation does not really cover this.
So what if my injury is work-related? Workman's compensation will always start paying on there. But if it's not work-related, then disability would kick in?
Then the personal disability insurance would kick in. It ends up being actually not a bad deal for somebody to get the disability insurance, just knowing that in the event something did happen, they would be covered and their income would continue on even though they're not working. It is expected that one-third of the population in Canada, on average, will go on disability, and on average, the length of that disability is about 2.5 years.
2.5 years?
2.5 years. So, on average, these are the statistics. If a person signs up for disability, their likelihood is one-third that they will go on a disability, and on average, the duration of that claim is about 2.5 years.
Hmm.
There are many claims which are shorter. For example, if somebody does break a leg or develops a one-month type of sickness of some sort. However, the main intention of the disability insurance is to cover in case something really bad goes wrong. And this is what it does. It covers in case something really bad goes wrong. If somebody is out of work and they cannot work for the rest of their life, with the disability insurance, their income would be in place until age 65.
So what different types of personal disability insurance are there?
Well, basically you have two different kinds. The first one is called cancelable, and the second kind is called non-cancelable. Basically, the cancelable insurance is a contract where the insurance company can change the insurance rates on the contract in the event that...
Rates, you mean like premiums?
The premiums that a person pays, they can actually change that if that group, that age group or that occupation group becomes a higher risk than previous. They can actually change the rates on the insurance.
Okay.
The non-cancelable insurance is a situation in a contract where they can't change that. Once a person signs up under the insurance, nothing.
So you're paying, say, even number, $100 a month, no matter how old you get, that rate won't go up or down. What about the actual remuneration?
The amount of the insurance coverage, yes, that also cannot change. Under the cancelable types, what ends up happening is very often if somebody gets disabled, they will have to prove their income at the time of disability, and then they'll get paid based on their proved income at that time. So if their proved income has gone down, they will not get covered fully.
I see. So, and a non-cancelable would be the other way around, where you get X amount of dollars per week or per month, no matter what your income is at the time that you claim.
Correct.
When you originally sign up for your insurance, you say you're making X amount of dollars per month, and then you get that dollar figure regardless then, I guess.
That's correct. It's just based on what happens when you signed up, and nothing in that policy changes. It's kind of a preferred policy to have, of course.
But that would be probably more expensive.
It's a little bit more expensive, but it's typically the one that results in the least surprises later on when something does happen.
Okay, so workman's compensation only really deals with living expenses. What do I do about my truck payments, mortgage payments, etc.?
Well, very often with the disability insurance, a person can get an additional insurance rider is what it's called. And what it will do is it will take over any business payments that are being made at that time. So if a person has the disability insurance, they can actually get covered for their living expenses. And with this additional rider, that if they would have had it at the beginning, then it will continue to make the payments that the corporation was making, such as truck payments.
Is that a business policy? So the corporation would actually have to take out this policy? Is it a personal one?
You can do either or. You can either have the corporation own it or you can have the individual own it.
What is the advantage of having disability insurance owned by the corporation or owned by yourself personally?
Let's say a person owns their a disability insurance through the corporation, and let's say they were required by some lending institution to have the disability insurance in place, then they have the option of claiming that as a business expense. But that presents another difficulty in that if somebody claims the expenses, then the benefits, once they start to come into effect, are taxable. So it's a catch-22. Because of the laws that limit the amount of coverage that can actually be implemented, it's most often highly recommended that somebody not claim their disability insurance as a business expense.
What about the riders?
The riders can be claimed, yes. The rider portion, for example, it's called business overhead expense. And if somebody is wishing to cover their truck payments, then that portion of the disability insurance can be claimed.
As an expense, and it's not taxable when it
comes
in.
Correct. It's not taxable.
Oh, what about your personal mortgage?
No, that wouldn't be covered. See, what ends up happening is it has to be something where the corporation is actually making the payments. Correct.
So if I get sick or injured, my personal disability insurance would cover that. And I'd want to have that disability insurance to be in a non-taxable status, correct?
Correct, yes.
There was one final option that's very interesting, other than workman's compensation and disability for breaking your leg or getting sick.
Well, the main topic here is income replacement in the event of somebody getting injured. And so one way to do that is to get the income replacement insurance. The second option that I do recommend is to save. And so a person can save and have an emergency fund in the event that something would happen where they'd be off work for a couple of months. I very highly recommend that option. One strategy that a person could incorporate is using the tax benefit of the difference in the per diem system to save money in the event that something would happen to them regarding disability.
So if a person is saving $7,000, $8,000, $10,000 a year, a portion of that should be set aside for disability or possible illness, sickness, that kind of thing.
I agree with that totally.
And so how much should an individual set aside generally?
Well, there's different schools of thought on that one, but the basic thing is if somebody has $0 in savings at this point, then to save all of it might not be a bad idea. Whereas if somebody has a pretty good slush fund in place, then perhaps they could take 20% of it, half of it, whatever they feel comfortable with.
So in terms of income replacement, how many months should a person have in savings as a slush fund? Should it be 1 month? Should it be 6 months?
I recommend 6 months. I think that's a safe option. Most people that I've seen who get into financial difficulty or trouble are people who have financial obligations that are not able to meet. Doing this saving almost ensures them of not getting into real difficulty in the event that something short-term would happen to them.
Okay, so I guess it's a little bit of personal preference. A person can be very comfortable with, you know, 3 or 4 months worth of savings, and that means your truck payments, your mortgage payments, your living expenses, 3, 4 months worth of reserves, or it could be 4, 6, 8 months, 10 months worth of reserves. What is the average time that an individual becomes disabled or sick?
Well, about 2.5 years is that a person on average, that's the average length of a disability. However, that takes into account the higher number of claims, which tend to be short in duration, and the fewer number of claims, which tend to be very long in duration, quite often up until age 65. And so those longer duration claims tend to bump up the average a little bit. Very often, if somebody breaks a bone that prevents them from trucking, they're usually back to work within a couple of months.
Sure. Unfortunately, I had a few clients who've had heart attacks, and it can take anywhere from, I don't know if I've ever seen anything less than 6 months, but it can be up to 2 years or longer before the individual gets their driver's license back again. So they could be easily suspended for 1.5 to 2.5 plus years in that situation anyway.
Then that's where the disability insurance would be a very good option to have had.
Yes, I agree. Medical plan. Can it be deductible? What's the best plan? The answer to this is yes, it can be deductible. If you keep all your medical bills paid with after-tax money and hand them in to your tax preparer at the end of the year, you will receive anywhere from 0 to 5% credit on your income tax return, depending on family income. This is why most people don't save medical receipts, because it makes such a very small difference. There is a better way. It's called medical trusts. Your corporation can reimburse you for your medical bills provided you have a medical trust. You should talk to a qualified provider for this. There are many knockoff trusts, which are actually not trusts. These knockoffs can cost your corporation the deductible status. Once again, either do it right or don't bother doing it at all. If properly set up, your corporation can write off 100% of your medical bills and reimburse you a non-taxable benefit. However, there is a one-time setup fee and user fee. Your provider should detail the costs. Even after all the costs, the net tax effect is 28 to 30% rather than 0 to 5%. What are the steps transferring everything into a corporation? Once you have the articles, you have to open a brand new bank account. The first deposit should be anywhere $100 to $200 depending on how many shares you want to issue. Then you present a void check to your accountant for CRA processing, the trucking company for payment of revenue, and whatever creditors you have, your truck payment, your trailer payment, APU payment, etc., should be all taken out of the new corporate account. Your accountant will sell or transfer your assets, truck, trailer, etc., into the corporation. They should also close your self-employed business, closing your personal GST account, and advise you on changing your cab card. Most people delegate this responsibility to their accountant. It is a fair bit of work. What if the book value of my truck is much lower than the market value? You have two options. The first is to pay recapture, sometimes referred to as capital gains, but it's really not. Depending on what time of year you incorporate, you may be reporting a very low income for the first year. Therefore, declaring a capital gains or recapture may not have a huge effect on you. The second option is transfer your assets into the corporation using a Section 85 rollover. It transfers the assets into the corporation without triggering a recapture. This is a very tricky process. Accountants dread Section 85 rollovers more than just about anything else. When the market value for trucks are very low, virtually nobody uses it. We've used it, but we much prefer to get a couple written evaluations from dealerships that reflect lower prices. When should my corporate year end be? Answer. If you already have a corporate year end, say in December, you should know how crammed it is February to April. You're left guessing at the numbers. I recommend mid-year. It allows you to work with perfect information before the end of the calendar year, so you can give charitably, purchase RRSPs on time, and complete personal income tax very quickly, if you have a refund, with much less information. A mid-year also allows you to smooth out earnings, claim income in advance, or slightly defer to the next calendar year. However, it can be overwhelming to some people because in one season you're dealing with a corporate return, and in another season you're dealing with personal taxes. If you do them in stages, they actually become less complicated. However, the best way to become familiar with the whole cycle is actually go through it for a couple of years. This is another reason why some people don't do it. It requires planning and commitment to a detailed cycle. Unless you have a great deal of business and tax knowledge, delegate this part. Have your accountant walk you through it step by step. The next question, corporate taxes versus T4 income tax, what is best? Good question. First, the assumption. Since most lease owner operators have only one truck or trailer and drive it themselves, usually the operator requires all proceeds just to live. Under most circumstances, it's best to claim the income as personal T4, which means the corporation should show a zero income every year. Actually, in Canada, 80% of all privately held corporations show a zero income. Here are the reasons why. Even though corporate taxes are calculated at a lower rate than personal taxes, it's based on the condition that the income stays in the corporation. The cheapest way to get it out is through dividends. Dividends have dividend taxes assessed to them, and the combination of corporate taxes and dividend taxes are higher than personal taxes. Therefore, it's cheaper to claim it personally, with two exceptions. First, if your personal taxable income is higher than $65,000 per year, or $130,000 husband and wife combined. If it is higher, then anything higher should be claimed through the corporation and dividends. However, that means the average operator's income has to double if they use the per diem system. You would definitely be in the top 10% of operators if that were true. The second exception, if you view Canada Pension Plan as a tax rather than a pension plan, dividends do not have Canada Pension Plan applied. Most people see it as a pension plan, not a tax. However, there are those who have no faith in CPP. We'll discuss that later. Question: what is the future of the Canada Pension Plan? We're back with Tim, and we'll talk about some CPP issues. Canada Pension Plan. Using the per diem system, the average individual will contribute approximately $2,000 a year less than the national average. It'll go down approximately 40-45%. To some people, that's good news, and to some people, that's bad news. I guess it's entirely on their perspective on Canada Pension Plan. Let's say, for instance, an individual starts their per diem system at age 58. They only have a few years before they retire. Contrast that with an individual who's 25 and starting the per diem system. He's got basically 30, 35, maybe even 40 years of work before retiring. If an individual only contributes 50, 55% of the maximum, it will affect their collection at the end, correct?
That is absolutely correct. Right now, the maximum benefit level is about $934 a month or $11,200 a year. And so if they reduce that payment by about 45%, then they can expect less when they go to collect CPP.
So it's a very individual kind of a situation, I guess, depending if an owner-operator or a lease operator is considering using the per diem system, what exactly it's going to affect their Canada pension. It can be quite dramatic, or it can be nothing at all.
That's correct.
Well, I shouldn't say nothing at all, maybe
pretty little. Pretty little, very minor effect.
So how exactly do we calculate the impact of the per diem system? In collecting the benefits of Canada Pension Plan, it's not like employment insurance. What you were making the last 2 weeks before applying, it has to do with what?
Well, basically, when a person becomes 18 and starts entering the workforce, and right up until the date that they retire, what they do is they take the average income of those people and they drop off the 8 lowest earning years and come up with an average and use that as a formula to figure out how much CPP a person can collect.
So is it based actually on what they really did contribute or not? Is it based on, let's say at the end of my life, I've totally contributed exactly $100,000 worth of Canada Pension Plan? Do they base it on that?
In one sense, they do actually base it on what you put in. It's not a formula that's derived on their actual contribution, but their actual contribution will be a reflection of what their income was. And so if their income is at a certain level, then they get that average income and then a percentage of that in their CPP benefit.
So it's a little bit of a hodgepodge of different contributions into the pool to determine what your dollar figure is at the end.
That's right, yeah.
I guess it emphasizes if you start the per diem system really early in life, it's going to have a much more dramatic effect. Much later in life, it's going to have a much smaller effect.
Exactly. You know,
Canada Pension Plan, when I talk to many truck drivers and people in general, they have two very different views of Canada Pension Plan. Some people view it as an actual pension plan where they expect to get money back. And others actually view it more like a tax where they could get something or they could not. It's all entirely up to the powers that be whether they're going to be getting anything. Let's maybe take a look at some of the changes that occurred in 2010 and see what happened to the people who were collecting and or applying it in 2010.
Well, basically, those who were collecting already, there are no changes for them. But those who are hoping to collect in the future, that's where the changes will come into effect. And what they've done is they've done a graduated scale for a few different areas that will take about 4 years in order for them to take effect.
So there's a lot of different new rules that are coming in for those that are applying.
Yeah, they can be basically narrowed down to about 4 different changes that have occurred.
Okay. Maybe before we go into what those changes are, let's take a look at what occurred in 2010. First of all, prior to 2010, was it better to collect your Canada Pension Plan at the age of 60 or 65? Maybe it depends a little bit on whether you know exactly when you're going to die. That's very important.
That's very true. Yeah, because if somebody knows they're going to die at 120 and they have enough money to retire at age 70, they can wait till age 70. And for that duration, they would have ended up collecting a lot more money than if they would have started at age 60 or 65. But there is a bit of a break-even point. In the old plan, that break-even occurred at 17 years down the road from age 60. So at about 77 years of age, they would have been better off to have waited till age 65. And now they've basically changed that so that the incentive is to wait till age 65 because the break-even point is only 14 years down the road as compared to 17. However, there's other things to take into account. such as when somebody's younger and they retire, they typically are spending more money than when they're older. If somebody is going to die, they typically become a little bit more feeble prior to death, and they end up slowing down their life, and they don't require as much money either. So there is a lot of incentive to take the money early.
So the changes that the government made in 2010 was basically incentivizing individuals to retire at a later date.
That's correct. Would you like to go through those changes?
Yeah, let's take a look at some of those changes.
Okay, well, the first change that has occurred is when somebody started to collect CPP, there was an earnings test that took place. And what they would do is they would look at the month that they started collecting and the month prior to them starting to collect. And if their income was above a certain amount, that was about $900 depending on what year, then basically if somebody had a higher amount than that, then they could not collect CPP. That earnings test has been completely removed.
So it's not a pass-fail anymore.
That's right. Most people would end up taking some time off work in order to pass that test.
I see.
What ended up happening in the past is people, once they started collecting CPP, they no longer made any CPP payments. Now what ends up happening is if somebody starts collecting CPP at age 60 or 61 or 62, 63, 64, then they continue to make CPP payments. And that's 9.9% of their income. Half of it is paid by the employer, half paid by the employee. And at age 65, they can elect to discontinue those payments if they want to, or they can keep on paying. What ends up happening is that the money that is paid into this CPP is actually called a post-retirement benefit, kind of separate from the CPP in that the money does get paid to them separate and above any maximums that they might have hit previous.
Oh, okay. So it's not like it disappears into thin air.
No.
We were looking at that at one point, and we kind of worried that you contribute and your number has already been set, so you actually get that money back, apparently.
That's right, yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's called a post-retirement benefit, and it's actually a pretty good system.
Okay.
There's always been an incentive for somebody to retire later in that they've given a higher amount of CPP if somebody waited until they were past 65 years old. 65 is considered the retirement age, and somebody can elect to take it earlier at age 60 if they want to, but there's actually a penalty in place if somebody decides to do that. And they've changed those numbers so as to encourage people to retire later. And
so in other words, they just increased the penalty.
Yeah. They used to have a 0.5% per month decrease in the CPP benefit prior to age 65 and a 0.5% bonus if you waited past age 65 up to a maximum of age 70 or a minimum of age 60. And they've increased those numbers. What they've done is the penalty has gone from 0.5% to 0.6%, and the bonus that a person gets has gone from 0.5% to 0.7%. So what ends up happening now, if somebody waits till age 70 to retire, they end up getting quite a significant more amount of money. The only thing is they're not collecting the CPP for as many years.
Okay. Is that one of the reasons why the break-even point went from 77 down to 73?
Exactly.
I see.
The fourth change that has occurred is that in calculating the CPP benefit, what they used to do is remove the lowest 7 earning years. And they've changed that. They've bumped it to 8. So now they remove the 8 lowest earning years, bumping up people's averages so that more people will be collecting the maximum amount.
So that's a little bit better then. They've actually made the formula a little bit better for the average Canadian then. But these are 4 changes that the government made to the CPP legislation. They can do quite a bit of tinkering. Around the world, there are different countries that are tinkering right now with their retirement benefits and their pension plans, whatever they classify or call them. It's sort of a global issue right now.
That's right. And obviously, there is some global pressure going on. There's some financial issues that are occurring. We've seen that in the shakeup a couple of years ago in the worldwide debt crisis that occurred. And we know that the fact that they've changed it now, we know that they could change it again in the future.
Canada is a very unique dynamic in terms that we have an aging population. What is the probability of them keeping it exactly the same and being able to meet their Canada Pension Plan obligations at the current existing formula and rate?
Well, I haven't designed an exact formula for that probability. However, I would say that it's quite high because when you take a look at it, in about 20 years or so, we'll have about 60% of the population in Canada will be retired, and that could present some problems.
So in 2030, say, 60% of our population is going to be retired. 40% will be paying Canada Pension Plan. Does our country have a whole bunch of savings account and set aside to pay for all of that?
Well, I heard they have a printing press somewhere. But basically, if somebody is collecting on average about $1,000 a month and 60% are retired, that means those 40% will having to be putting at least $1,500 a month into CPP payments in order to keep those 60% going.
One thing that I worried about during our research, or just prior to our research, was that, yes, we will have Canada Pension Plan, and they may give us a couple $1,000s in a month. The only thing is that once we cash it, we go out and we buy an $80 cup of coffee. In our research, we found out that actually CPP is indexed to inflation.
It is indexed to inflation at this point. The only thing is, will they be able to maintain that? And yes, inflation will have a big impact on this at some point.
Sounds very much like a house of cards.
Correct. It is a house of cards. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to give my personal opinion here when it comes to Canada Pension Plan, and this is my personal opinion. I'm not a huge believer in the government controlling absolutely everything that we do. I don't want to rely my entire future, especially my retirement, on the good graces of the government, especially when they can control and change the rules at any point in time. And it'll be a difference between, you know, eating dog food or not. I would rather not leave that choice up to the government. Canada, for the most part, is a socialist country. This particular CD seminar is designed to talk to drivers and lease owner-operators. Lease owner-operators are quite independent-minded. They would not fall under the category as a socialist. They are much more free market-oriented in their thinking. But Canada as a whole is a socialist country, or much more socialist for sure than the United States. Leaving my retirement, or leaving anyone's retirement, in the hands of the government gives me an uneasy feeling. If my $8,000-$10,000 a year stays in my hands as opposed to in the government's hands, I then have a natural obligation to take that money and to set it aside for my future. Because if I'm taking it out of the hands of the government and I'm putting it into my pocket, that is basically saying by my actions that I'm responsible for my future and you, the government, are not. It's an awesome philosophical choice, I guess. If you're going to be using the per diem system, you have to accept the responsibility for your own future. So ultimately, the conclusion is, do you rely on the government for your retirement, or do you rely on yourself? Question. What about incorporating without a per diem versus self-employed? There are many operators who have become incorporated but still do not get a per diem check every month. Their accountants fill out their tax returns using the TL2. Operators have to understand the difference between the per diem and TL2 $51 per day. The TL2 $51 is not a per diem. The TL2 is a non-refundable tax credit. And there is a difference. The per diem is valued at $85.20 plus showers and amenities of $15, giving a total of $100.20 per day, with an increase due April 1st of 2011. The 2011 TL2 non-refundable tax credit is valued at $13.60 per day on your income tax return. And the self-employed meal receipts for 2011, if you average $20 to $25 per day in meal receipts, between $5.33 and $6.67 per day. These numbers are huge. $100.20 per day, $13.60 per day, or approximately $6 to $6.50 per day. Question. What does my first year with a corporation look like? Answer. Complicated. If you set the year end halfway through the year, say June 30th or July 31st, there are three possible levels of complexity. Here they are, from the most complex to the least. First, if you incorporated early in the year, number one, you have a partial self-employed year, say January to April. Then you also have a partial corporate year ending, say, June 30th, in which you claim T4 salary for May and June and claim T4 bonus that clears out any corporate earnings made between May and June. Then the third step is you have an unfinished corporate year, July 1st to December 31st, and you'll be claiming T4 salary July to December. That's the first level of complexity. Second, if you incorporate exactly halfway through the year, you will have half a year of self-employed earnings, January to June 30th. You will have an unfinished corporate year, July 1st to December 31st, claiming T4 salary July to December. The third level of complexity is if you incorporate at the end of the year. You have most of your year self-employed earnings, January to, say, October 31st. You will also have an unfinished corporate year, November 1st to December 31st, say, claiming T4 salary only November and December. What does my second year with a corporation look like? Moderately complicated. If you set your year end halfway through the year, June 30th or July 31st, there will be moderate complexity. You have a partial corporate year end ending, say, June 30th. You'll be claiming T4 income for January to December. It includes January to June T4s, plus you'll also be claiming T4 bonus that clears out any corporate earnings made on year ending June 30th. Then you will also have July to December salaried T4 expensed in next corporate year. Your personal income tax is completed sometime between January and April. It will be a T1 general, which includes only T4 income, along with all your personal T1 information, dependents, RSPs, charitable donations, property tax, etc. The second year isn't nearly as complicated as the first. Should I donate to charity through my corporation or through my personal account? Good question. Answer? Personal, always. Almost never should the corporation donate to charity. Your tax-deductible donation is much more valuable to you personally than your corporation. By law, charities must write out the receipt to the entity that donated. They cannot accept a corporate check and write the receipt to you. There are moderate exceptions to this rule, but given that you're a lease owner-operator, this is almost always the rule. Can my children work and be paid by my corporation? Answer? Yes, anyone can. But I know what the real question is. Can I pay them contract work? No taxes taken off. Answer? Both no and yes. No, because everyone must pay taxes on income they earn. However, there is a yes. Below a certain point, income isn't taxed. A child can make $4,500 per year without it affecting their status as a dependent. That means $4,500 from all sources. That's $375 per month. Auditors will want to make sure of two things. Did the individual actually perform any work, washing the truck, greasing, etc.? And there also must be an audit trail or checks deposited into the child's account. They must be available. Can short-hauling day cabbers collect a per diem? Answer. Yes. Remember the auditor? If they left home before 8 a.m., they got a breakfast per diem. They divided up their per diem meal by meal. Remember the co-pilot? He got $4 for every hour he was away from his home terminal. He divided it up hour by hour. Everything depends on the employer-employee agreement. However, there are two additional conditions when an employee is home every night. The first is showers and amenities are not allowed, obviously. The second, the expense is restricted to travel meal reductions, 80%. Remember the lunch bag letdown campaign increased travel meal deductibility from 50 to 80%. The employer, your corporation, can only expense your per diem at the travel meal expense rate. This information is found in G400-3-3, but more specifically IT-518. And here I'll quote Revenue Canada's source. Accordingly, amounts are not restricted if paid for food or beverages for employees at locations where, due to its remoteness from any established community, the employee could not reasonably be expected to establish and maintain a self-contained domestic establishment. Driving long distance, you cannot be expected to maintain a self-contained domestic establishment. However, when you are a day cabber, you can be expected to establish a self-contained domestic establishment. Therefore, amounts are restricted. Without getting too technical, the information is found in the Excise Tax Act, Section 236, not the Income Tax Act, Section 67.1. However, they are paralleled or linked. October 1, 2010 provides a per diem amount of $85.20, reduced to 80%, makes $68.16 expensed. The GST input tax credit on that $68.16 would be only $3.25 per day. Compare that to the GST input tax credits of $4.06 on $85.20 for long-haul drivers, plus hours and amenities portion. Note, of course, no GST input tax credits for any U.S. days. However, exchange rate is applied. So as a summary, yes, you can have a per diem. However, it is reduced by 20%. Sheesh, could have said that right from the start rather than quoting all those numbers. Can you give per diem by the mile, say 10 or 15 cents per mile? Absolutely not. Per diem is calculated based on time per day, not productivity or work. If someone tries to use another form of base calculation, auditors will reject it, period. How does the new system affect cash flow? The answer depends on how you manage your cash flow right now. Operators manage their cash flow right now in various ways. Some separate personal and business finances completely. They even give themselves a regular draw into their personal home account. They may also set aside a fixed amount every month for year-end taxes. Others treat their business income as personal cash flow. They pay their mortgage and groceries from the same account as their deposits. It's not illegal to do that because they are sole proprietors. However, it is confusing to know how much you're making or how much you're not making. And taxes at the end of the year is usually a surprise. If you are the type that already separates personal and business, the effect the per diem system has will be minimal. If you are the type that does not separate personal and business, the effect the per diem system will have may be dramatic. Here's an overview. Clear separation of business and personal finances is essential in a corporation. Do not pay personal bills from corporate account. Example, groceries, mortgage, hydro bills, Toys R Us, etc. Unless you have a sizable line of credit or cash in your corporation, it may be awkward at first. You must synchronize company cash flow with personal cash flow needs. It's not difficult if you're used to being paid once a month, but if you get paid multiple times in a month, you must coordinate timing conflicts. Instead of personal drawings, here is the list of cash transfers into personal from corporate account. You'll be paid a salary, a separate per diem check or subsistence allowance, personal vehicle log remuneration by kilometer usage, shareholder loan repayments, say $500, $2,500, $5,500, whichever is available. Some people call these advances annual bonus or even management fees, but not technically. It is a very good idea that if an advance is taken, even out of your corporation to your personal account, that an additional one-third of your advance be taken from your corporate checking and placed into a corporate savings account for source deductions on potential annual bonus. For example, if you advance draw $1,500 from the company and place it into your personal account, the corporation should set aside $500 in savings. Annual bonuses are not always an exact reflection of cash flow, so using this system is preparing for the worst case. Some shareholders are owed money by their corporation, and there won't be any tax implications from drawing cash. However, if you follow this rule, you will never have problems with taxes. Note, there is a monthly source deductions that must be sent in on your salary. Remember, most people find this system complex. It takes the average operator 2 to 6 months to become comfortable with the process. How much should my salary be? The answer to this varies. Generally, as low as appropriate. Too high and your corporation can't afford you. If you earn a salary of $5,000 per month, source deductions would be about $1,400 every month. National averages would suggest this would be too high. Most of our clients are on a salary of $1,000 per month. That makes a calculation of $906.94 after deductions. We include an extra $30 for additional taxes. Source deductions are $128.12 per month, which is an acceptable dollar figure to send into Revenue Canada. Don't panic. That's not all they take home. Remember, they also get a per diem check and personal vehicle log check and a bonus at the end of the year. Ultimately, you have the final choice what your salary will be. One word of caution. If you make your salary too high, your corporation may show a loss in the same year when you have to personally declare T4 income. It's not tax efficient. However, loss carryforwards are easily carried forward in a corporation. You have to pay EI on earnings. No. Anyone who owns more than 40% of a corporation is EI exempt. You can't collect, so you don't have to remit. If you know of someone who did collect, they were lucky. They fell through the cracks somewhere. However, you may remit if you voluntarily register, but I advise not to. The long-term obligations and restrictions are considerable. Short-term gain, long-term pain. Next question. I don't know what I'm doing. It's overwhelming. Can someone teach me step by step? Answer? Yes. Actually, it's the preferred method of learning the system. Nobody starts out as an A-rated client immediately. Every month that goes by, you'll feel more and more comfortable. After a couple of years, most people actually view it as easier and more informative than the self-employed system. Next, how does the per diem affect child tax credit, child support, alimony, etc.? Canada Revenue Agency does not recognize per diem as income. Therefore, child tax credit will go up in the summer following the first year's filing. The courts usually don't acknowledge per diem either, usually. Therefore, child support and alimony will be calculated based on line 150 of your return. Usually, the payment will be decreased. However, it must be applied through the courts, and the courts have not always been consistent in their application. Sometimes it's based on how good your lawyer is, sometimes not. Always on the judge's perception. What's the difference between subsistence allowance and per diem? Answer, nothing. In name only. I used the term subsistence allowance in my book, but found that using it in a seminar over and over again is actually a little tongue twister. So I changed it to per diem. What is the origins of the per diem system? Specifically, who, when was it first applied to lease owner-operators? As you remember, historically, the trucking industry used it prior to the 1980s, same as, say, pipeline welders. I wrote about the origins of the subsistence allowance in my blog, and I'll just read it straight from that source. Back in 1991, a trucking company was working for and with a pipeline company with varied contracts and results. They had a high GST return, then low, and vice versa. The fluctuation flagged a GST audit. The auditor, apparently a very helpful one, scoured through the books and found out why and was satisfied. The audit produced no reassessments. All things were done well. The jolly and apparently robust auditor asked why the company wasn't claiming the GST on the flat rate meal allowance and accommodation allowance provided the pipeline welders, ranging from $95 to $125 per day. He conveniently calculated the amount to $143,000 expensed at about $2 million. To state that the auditor was helpful is a six-figure understatement. One of the consultants who were working for the company at the time had a long chat with the auditor. In the end, the auditor informed him that there was nothing stopping the trucking industry from providing the allowance to drivers and collecting back the ITC, GST Memorandum 400-3-11 and 400-3-3, the resultant opportunity was exposed. According to my limited research and knowledge, this is the roots of the opportunity. However, tracking the initial exposure to present is like finding the tail end to a bowl of spaghetti. There appears to be a lot of starts and stops. If I start to mention names and companies, I run the risk of including or excluding a whole lot of people. That is the basic history of per diem or subsistence allowance for truckers. Can my accountant set me up to use the per diem system? The answer is yes. A qualified accountant should be able to. However, some may not want to, or they won't without you signing a waiver. They probably know the liability behind the system and need to protect their interests. Remember, they are dependent on you providing the audit trail. Many bookkeepers and T1-only preparers usually cannot. If you're still interested and this is the case, contact our office. We may be able to find someone locally for you. Who else is using this system for lease owner-operators? Actually, several firms are. Some even are doing a good job, as far as I can see. However, between September 2007 and December 2010, no other firms have openly advertised and promoted that they use it. I believe that in order for the system to be accepted nationally, there must be publicity and national application. It was one of the reasons I wrote my book in 2007. Eventually, say 2015 plus, most accountants should be able to use it openly without fear. However, until then, I personally believe firms must specialize and educate operators or associate in order to make it a viable service. Practically speaking, specializing simply means the accounting firm has a vested interest in ensuring each client is successful. If one of their clients is reassessed, they must defend it or eventually lose their entire practice. What kind of information does THR need every month to keep updated records? Each month, an envelope should be dropped off. It includes bank statements from the corporation, pay statements from the company you're leased onto, maintenance invoices, completed personal vehicle log, per diem subsistence allowance forms, any loose receipts of business expenses paid by yourself. Either it will be reimbursed to you by your company or it's kept track of through a shareholder loan account, reconciled at the end of the year. Meal receipts from business meetings, not on the road, such as directors or shareholders meetings. Home expenses, hydro, telephone, internet, taxes, repairs, insurance, etc. Credit card receipts, statements alone are usually not enough. Any large U.S. purchases, such as maintenance, should be stamped by Canada Customs upon re-entry into Canada. Cell phone bills. Many operators have their cell phones paid by credit card. Retain both statement and as detailed invoices as possible. Some clients provide originals and some photocopies, whatever you're comfortable with. For those who wish to go digital, this list can be sent email, but CRA is not entirely consistent in accepting them. Most of the time they are, so keep originals. One of the most important thing about paperwork is that it's punctual. Late paperwork always delays GST returns or year ends. Here's a couple of things we do not want. Personal vehicle receipts such as gas, maintenance, lease payments, insurance, etc. Since you have your personal vehicle log, you won't need these. Plus also any meal receipts while you were on the road. This is now a personal expense and is handled by your per diem. I'd like to overview our accounting firm's standards and perspectives. We deal only with lease owner operators. We have a few operators with their own running rights, and technically they are trucking companies, but they only have one truck. Once a trucking company grows to three trucks, I call the owner and notify them that we only deal with lease owner operators. We start searching for a suitable accountant who can assist them in their growth. Some of our operators have businesses on the side. As a standard, we don't allow this. The only exception is when the business is very small and the operator provides a one-page summary of gross income and gross expenses. We just assign miscellaneous income and miscellaneous expenses to the income statement. Once again, we reserve the right not to do this. We have chosen to focus exclusively on lease owner operators using the per diem system. We don't want to deviate from that model. One final thing about businesses on the side. There are many trucking households who also operate self-employed businesses, specifically a multi-level marketing business. Many have asked my opinions of them. I will give you my final answer. Many MLMs sell fine product, unique and quality-based products that cannot be bought in stores. However, they are generally expensive because of the quality or uniqueness of the products and the commission rates associated with the business model. Some people find value in the product, some don't. Sometimes my wife and I find value in them. Usually we don't. I have privately evaluated MLMs in the past when clients have asked me about them, but I have never publicly endorsed them, and I never intend to. I will not sign up, even if I could save 35 to 50% off the retail price. If I need the product that bad, I will simply pay full retail. This has been our policy since some time before 2003, when I started focusing specifically on per diem accounting for operators. I have also asked my staff to honor this policy commitment. And yes, I understand its legal implications. I'm not for regulating my staff during their off time, but I am trying to protect the focus and integrity of our firm. I'll also state the obvious. I pledge that our client list will never be sold, rented, or made available to anyone, not even partial lists. I have a personal and business philosophy I'd like to share. If at all possible, I don't burn bridges. In my life, I'm currently 48, I've probably burnt 6 or 7 bridges, and I wish I'd not participated in 4 or 5 of them. As I get older, I value patience more. However, some people are habitually both deceptive and dangerous, worth the match to burn the bridge, but most are not. I've chosen a business model that does not create excess potential losses. Switching to a monthly pay-as-you-go model has much less risk. Now, if a client leaves, and it has occurred, though most come back, we have the luxury to ensure the smoothest transition possible, most times doing much more than is reasonable from an industry standard. I'm reminded of a story I heard many years ago. An operator had worked for a trucking company for 18 years. Apparently, he was getting too old for the job and decided it was time to move to a less demanding one. His wife had washed the family car in the company wash bay every Friday for over 12 years. On the last check the operator received, he was billed $35 for her car wash. This was a huge insult to them. They told 2 friends who told 2 friends who told 2 friends. I'm not sure how many times I've heard it in interviews, but I know it directly stopped at least 6 or 7 operators from moving their trucks onto the company. That $35 investment converted into over $1 million of lost revenue annually. At THR, we're not quite where I want to be, but we're very close and getting closer. I aim to always offer superior service and value without acting defensive. What about my books? Several times I've been asked about the origins of my book, Making Your Miles Count, Taxes, Taxes, Taxes. I started writing it in 2002. I was motivated by a couple clients being literally ripped off by the trucking company they were working for. Outright theft is the only description I could describe it as. No need to worry about the company anymore. They've long been bankrupt. But there are many more companies that were quick to take their place, acting the same way. I realized there was no real scientific way to compare companies. It's too much trial and error. And some errors devastate families. So I took on the task of writing a book. After writing part-time for about 2 years, I realized I had a problem. Combined with the research I had from my master's thesis and my accumulating research, My book was going to be over 400 pages. I mentioned this to a close friend and he asked, how many drivers would read a 400-page book? I said, about 6 to 10. We laughed, but the point was made. Thought as I might, I couldn't come up with a solution. I only did what I thought was right. Continued writing. By fall of 2006, my estimation of 400-plus pages were looking fairly accurate. I hadn't a clue how to fix the problem. Then I got a eureka experience. I was driving on the highway and the radio just announced our local MP just received a posting as the president of the Treasury Board of Canada. It got me thinking about the chapter I wrote on taxes, aptly called Taxes, Taxes, Taxes. I included into my thoughts the fresh launching of the Lunchbag Letdown campaign, the failure of the class action lawsuit against CRA by close to 2,200 truckers, and the passing of the Federal Accountabilities Act. The chapter on taxes itself was over 70 pages, and I didn't include stuff like GST issues, etc. The chapter itself could be a book. Da-da-da-da! The light went on. I could write the book as a series rather than a single publication. I'll just tack on all the rest of the government tax issues and publish it as the first in a series. And thus the first step in three was taken. My life since the publication has been very busy. Busy and exciting. The research has been stored for years, and the book building in focus and intensity. I still want to retain some form of a life, so I figure 4 to 5 years between books is the pace I'm comfortable with. However, the firm has grown and other projects have come alongside it. My book was published in April 2007, a month after the Conservatives passing the graduated 50 to 80% meal deductibility law. I waited until it passed before I published it, commenting on the national effects, and then started writing monthly articles on a couple magazines beginning in 2008. I released the book in CD format in 2009 and worked nearly all 2010 on this seminar. 2011 will find me doing two basic things, working with accounting firms nationally and completing my second book, Making Your Miles Count, Choosing a Trucking Company. I will go at a pace that doesn't sacrifice my family. It's better to have a good product come out late than to suffer indefinitely with an inferior product. In 1992, North American engine makers turned electronic. Statistically, most operators increased their fuel economy. I had an operator tell me he was trading in his 6-month-old truck for a new one because he saved almost an entire truck payment every month. That made good business sense. Dealerships benefited by strong value. However, today you have the exact opposite effect. When the emissions rules came in, fuel economy dropped. Then, when the next stage of changes came in, maintenance issues skyrocketed by double digits. If a trucking company returns 20 trucks and hires a lawyer for $50,000 to defend their purchase of lemons, that's only $2,500 per truck. But if all you have is one truck, can you or should you hire a $50,000 lawyer to save you $50,000? Operators have suffered untold hardships through this climate gate. Companies who demand operators purchase trucks less than 5 years old, ultimately, do not care for your well-being. They're playing a statistical numbers game with insufficient data. Some operators have been driving successfully for decades and have been wiped out by policies, requirements, and restrictions. Don't play by the statistics. They lie. You're in business. Reduce your risks. That's your responsibility, not the salesman's, not the bank, not the financing companies, not the dealership. You have to be able to predict your costs. If your risks are too high, it may not be worth it. Yes, I know that's not good information for dealerships. But they sure had it good in the past. They may well be a victim of Climate Gate too. These are my opinions. Take it or leave it. Many times I'm asked how the Canadian economy is going. I'd like to place that question into perspective. When our currency was 65 to 75 cents of the U.S. dollar, our U.S. exports were 80%. Now, hovering around par, it's still 75% of Canadian exports. Like it or not, we are tied to the U.S. economy. So the real question is, how's the U.S. economy? Because that will determine our future. We are an export country, rich in natural resources. We must export. The financial meltdown of 2008 brought a global change in currency and economics. With global monetary easing, or printing of money, inflation will soon be our barometer. This means 1970s or worse. If the U.S. doesn't control their money, the world will change as we have always known it. Get out of debt, get out of debt, get out of debt. I don't know the future, but that advice holds safety no matter what the outcome. These are my opinions. Take it or leave it. THR Consulting Group Limited sponsored this seminar. Expect other products and services in the future. My second book is entitled Making Your Miles Count, Choosing a Trucking Company, and is designed to scientifically revolutionize the way you choose the company you operate at. Keep an eye out for it. First, I must provide a disclaimer about any legal advice. Any advice provided herein is solely for educational purposes, and THR Consulting Group Limited recommends individuals seek personal legal advice for their needs. THR Consulting is not responsible for individual applications. This CD seminar was released in January 2011, free of charge. It took almost a year to produce, a lot longer than I thought it would. Costs for producing this seminar have been kept as reasonable as possible. If the quality of the sound is not perfect, please remember, we were emphasizing the value of the content. THR intends to service as many operators as practically possible. We have various offices and franchise locations to serve you, as well as other lease owner operator products in line for release. On this CD is a client number that is used as a referral reference. Please have that available if you call. I do have some bad news, though. In the summer of 2011, our accounting fees will be increasing for our existing clients by 6.25%. For any clients who sign up after our summer deadline, the increase will be 15.625%. Therefore, if you decide to get serious about your tax options, the summer of 2011 will provide you the best value. I hope you found this seminar helpful. More than likely, you need to listen to it several times. You may still have additional questions. The Income Tax Act is very complex and usually must be customized further than this seminar implies. Take the time to consider the impact this has on your business and personal life. You can contact me at robert@thrconsulting.ca or 877-987-9787. I return all emails as soon as possible. Phone calls, though, are a little tardy. Have a good trip.